I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. Republicans have proposed a sweeping overhaul to the tax code. Some of the changes involve deductions that have been baked into the cake of the code for generations, and the impact on the deficit is huge. The president called for the death penalty for the man accused of killing 8 and wounding 12 in New York. That might complicate matters for prosecutors as the case proceeds, and Donna Brazile has certainly complicated matters for a Democratic Party that continues to wrestle with how best to oppose the Trump administration. The biggest fan of her new book appears to be the president himself. Eugene Scott of The Washington Post joins me for a look at domestic news, and Amira Woods of the Institute for Policy Studies updates us on the elections in Liberia and Kenya and the U.S. military role in Africa. Plus, the Full Circle Dance Company takes on domestic violence. First, the news. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Happy Friday. Thanks for joining us for Midday. So Republicans have released some but not all of the details of a tax plan that they characterize as the most dramatic revision to the tax code in more than 30 years. There are fewer brackets and fewer deductions for some taxpayers, plus lower rates for corporations. So do they have enough votes to get it passed? If it is to pass, a certain level of compromise will be necessary. On Monday, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly commented that it was a lack of an ability to compromise that led to the Civil War. The president called for a swift legal action against the driver of the truck that killed 8 and wounded 12 in New York. Legal scholars fear his remarks may complicate the prosecution. A new book by former DNC chair Donna Brazile says essentially that Bernie Sanders' complaints about the committees favoring the Clinton campaign were justified. And lawmakers on Capitol Hill want Attorney General Jeff Sessions to justify how forthcoming he's been concerning contacts with George Papadopoulos, who has pleaded guilty to lying to officials in the Russia investigation. And last night in Baltimore, three more people were victims of homicide, pushing the total number of murders in our city for the year past 300. Organizers are calling for another ceasefire this weekend in an effort to curb the violence. A judge has ruled that Bo Bergdahl will not serve any time in prison for deserting his post in Afghanistan. And here at home, the state is reeling from the decision by CSX Railroad not to pursue an expansion of its Howard Street tunnel. So we won't get to all of that, but we will take a stab at some of it. And later in the program, I'll be joined by a scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies for a conversation about recent developments in Africa. But first, for a look at the national news, I'm pleased to welcome Eugene Scott. He writes about identity politics for the Washington Post politics blog, The Fix. Good afternoon, Eugene. Welcome to the show. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
So the tax bill. Obviously, there are winners and losers. What are the main talking points that the Republicans are pumping up to make their case?
Well, their main talking point is actually dismissing the suggestion that this is something that primarily benefits the wealthy and major corporations. Their argument is that that is an attack the Democrats usually hurl at conservatives. But quite frankly, based on what we see available so far, which of course is not the whole thing, it does appear to benefit mainly big corporations, and it's not yet clear how it will benefit middle and working class families. However, in the Republicans' defense, the argument is that when big corporations are benefited, they are put in a position where they can create more jobs and invest in America's economy long term, and that will ultimately benefit working and middle class families.
They are calling this the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, so they are linking those two things. The New York Times editorial board, and I apologize for mentioning the New York Times, the evil New York Times, to a reporter for the Washington Post, but bear with me. They called it a tax plan for a new gilded age. And it's interesting that Republicans are no longer talking about the terrible effects of deficits, because there are some estimates that say that this is going to put the United States in a very serious deficit position.
Well, that's exactly what Democrats are saying, because when you are decreasing taxes for corporations, the question then becomes, so where is the money going to come from to make up the difference if corporations are paying fewer taxes? And Democrats are arguing that that could come from people who are already overly taxed, and it's not quite clear what the Republicans have proposed to replace that. Like I said earlier, details are still forthcoming, and there's quite a bit more that we all have to learn about it.
During the election, a lot of people noticed that there was a tremendous metro-rural divide in the country. People who live in and around cities, as well as opposed to people who live in rural areas. There seems to be a divide here between certainly East and West, people on the coasts in New York, California, other places, and even people in the Midwest, but states like Illinois, when they have high taxes, state and local taxes. The Republicans are proposing that those no longer be deductible on their federal returns. So you've got even some Republicans in those high tax states saying that that's not a good idea, that that's something that's been part of the code for a long time and it needs to stay in there.
Yeah, absolutely. So under this bill for new mortgages, they would be able to deduct interest payments made only on their first $500,000 worth of home loans. And this is something of concern in people in more expensive areas in the country. Those more expensive areas, of course, are much more likely to be major cities on the coast, like New York and Washington, D.C., San Francisco and Boston. And so there's some concern that people who live in urban metropolitan areas, which, mind you, are also areas that overwhelmingly did not support Trump, may not benefit from this plan as much as some rural working class voters in the heartland.
The Republicans also make a big point to point out that the returns, when you fill out your tax returns, it will be much more simple, they allege. Speaker Ryan even going so far as to saying, you know, tax returns will now be able to be submitted on a postcard. How do you think that's going to resonate in the body politic? Is the simplicity of this tax proposal going to be one of its salient selling points?
They're trying to make it that way, and I think most Americans feel like the process of filing taxes is more complicated than it needs to be, but I don't think simplicity is the main solution that people are seeking when it comes to their tax plan and what they would like to see revised. I think many middle and working class families on both sides of the aisle are focused on making sure that credits for child care are at their highest as possible, and that it becomes more beneficial for working families to raise kids in the current economy, whether or not filing taxes is simple or complicated.
It's interesting that oftentimes the people who are opposing specific provisions of this plan point to the fact that these provisions that they want to maintain in the tax code have been part of Internal Revenue Service policy and the code for generations, things like deducting mortgage interest or things like deducting your state and local taxes. And they're basically saying, because it's been around for so long, we should not take this opportunity to get rid of it. We need to find the money some other way. I wonder how that's going to fly as an argument that, you know, because it's been part of the tax code for all this time, it should stay part of the tax code.
I think that argument will not stand up if the conservatives can present something that is new and better. The idea that change can be something that brings improvement to voters is something that I think people on both sides of the aisle embrace. They just need to see some tangible facts and support for that. That it's not yet clear because, as we said earlier, more information is still forthcoming. But I don't think the whole "this is how it's always been" argument is going to stand if a new proposal is introduced that is actually better.
Yeah, I think you're right. They did reduce 7 brackets to 4, and they've got some things that have simplified things, and they probably have got some things that are going to encourage people not to itemize their deduction. And there are people who point out that if fewer people are itemizing their deductions, things like charitable donations and whatnot will no longer be an incentive under the tax code. So we will keep on top of that, of course. I also want to talk about General John Kelly's really remarkable remarks earlier in the week. He was on the Fox News program hosted by Laura Ingraham, where he talked about Robert E. Lee, the Confederate general, as an honorable man, and said that the reason that the Civil War happened was because of a failure for people to compromise. What are people making of that?
Well, people are significantly frustrated when you look at all the compromises that went into the Civil War in terms of ideas such as like the Three-Fifths Compromise and the lack of full equality granted to black people despite the South losing. I think what we're seeing more broadly when I look at when I speak to voters is just an administration that they aren't convinced recognizes slavery and the Civil War and the Confederacy as being such tragic incidents as they were for significant numbers of the American people. And I think there are politics behind certainly how the White House talks about these issues and what their intent and goals are, and their very selective language in terms of how they memorialize Robert E. Lee and people who fought for the Confederacy.
And, of course, Confederate monuments have needled their way into the Virginia governor's race, which a lot of folks think is pretty tight. Ed Gillespie, former head of the Republican National Committee, wants to restore them. I'm for them. My opponent's against them. President Trump tweeted that, that Gillespie would save our great statues and heritage. So the Confederacy is a recurring theme in the Republican Party when they're making pitches to voters these days, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at support for statues for Confederate memorials, it seems to be pretty partisan racially, quite frankly, and even politically. And so it very much has been broken down to an issue that you can pretty much guess where people stand based on their ethnicity. I think what's very interesting, though, is how many black voters are watching how Democrats respond to this issue. Democrats very much are interested in putting a dent in Donald Trump's white working class support, and they're trying to figure out how best to do that. And I think many black voters who historically have obviously voted for the Democratic Party are just keeping an eye on it to make sure that their support is not taken for granted in the effort to reach this demographic that hasn't always been in support of the Democratic Party.
And speaking of the Democrats, they've got some kissing and making up to do in light of Donna Brazile's really bombshell of a book. It's going to be released next week. There was an excerpt from the book published in Politico yesterday. It seems like she's saying, from a firsthand account as the temporary chair, the interim chair of the Democratic National Committee, that the Clinton campaign controlled the purse strings of the DNC and ergo controlled the entire process. And so the complaints that we heard from the Sanders campaign that it was, fixed for Hillary Clinton appear to be borne out.
That is certainly how many people who are on the left, who weren't on Clinton's side, are interpreting this, that she went in with an unfair advantage that disadvantaged Sanders and other lawmakers as well who were interested in the nomination. I think what's more interesting more broadly than rehashing the 2016 election is seeing how the current president is trying to respond to this issue, what he would like the FBI and Justice Department to do in terms of investigations. He really seems to think that this is a much bigger story related to the 2016 campaign than what's been revealed this past week regarding members affiliated with his team and Russia.
And not known to be a big book reader, it seems that the president is a big fan of this book. It's doubtful he's read it yet or ever will read it, but it's interesting that he is using it as a talking point. Three conservative House Republicans, this was reported in your paper this morning, are expected sometime today to file a resolution calling on Bob Mueller to recuse himself from the Russia probe. They are bringing up the talking points of the Uranium One deal, this Canadian uranium company that had a deal approved during the Obama administration, as well as the fact that the Clinton campaign was one of two parties involved in compensating this group called Fusion GPS to do opposition research on the Trump campaign. What do you make of the Republicans' efforts to refute every and all aspects of the Russia investigation by bringing up these other two issues?
Right. I mean, we know there's a Republican lawmaker, Matt Gaetz, who's saying that Mueller has a conflict of interest because he was serving as FBI chief during that time in the Obama administration. But I think to critics, this may look like an underhanded way to get Mueller removed from these investigations as a whole that are not revealing the most favorable results for President Donald Trump and many of his conservative supporters, including those in Congress. And so I think there definitely will be an effort to get to the heart of what all of these things are really about, and not allow the focus to be on this deal that happened in 2010 compared to what happened less than a year ago.
And the Republicans have already started two congressional probes into these matters, so we'll see where they end up. Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, has some splaining to do, as we used to say. He was evidently present at a meeting in March of 2016 in which George Papadopoulos was also present, and they discussed contacting Russia. However, Attorney General has some memory problems, it seems, because yet again, he was unable to recall that for congressional investigators the last time he appeared before them. And it looks like perhaps he might be asked to either appear again in person or at least respond in writing and revise his testimony. Where do you think that's going to go?
Well, it certainly will lead to him being asked more direct questions from lawmakers on both sides of the aisle who really want to get to the bottom of this investigation. Whether or not he's going to be able to recall with specificity anything from those conversations isn't seeming likely right now just because of his inability to tap into what happened already, but I think efforts to get some type of details and provide some type of clarity will be in the best interest of Sessions and many affiliated with the Trump administration, because in the event that he cannot, it is going to be perceived by critics as an effort to cover up really important information that may have happened related to conversations between the Trump administration and Russian officials.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting and a little perplexing that he said he couldn't remember the meeting, but now he does remember telling Papadopoulos that he didn't want any more. He didn't want Papadopoulos to move forward with his efforts to set up a meeting between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump. It's kind of interesting what you remember and what you don't. With the Mueller investigation, does it appear that the administration is kind of circling the wagons? I mean, what's the mood in Washington among people in the administration? We hear from Vanity Fair a couple of days ago that, you know, there are people in the West Wing who are lawyering up like crazy. And even we have people like Gary Cohn, Council of Economic Advisors, making sure he's not even in the room for any discussion of Russia. Do you think folks in the administration are running a little scared and increasing in their concern? We got Hope Hicks, the communications director, being put in front of the committee or investigators next week. Things seem to be ratcheted up more now than they were a week ago.
Some certainly are, right, especially because I think about 2 weeks ago, right before Mueller's first charges, there was cohesion among conservatives in Washington trying to focus on the Democrats and Hillary and what happened on the left. But I think what last week, or I guess earlier this week, revealed is that we're just at the beginning of what may come out of Mueller's probe. And so I think people are trying to make sure they're covering all of their bases as much as possible, trying to spend time distancing themselves from situations and conversations currently that could put them at risk of being in trouble with the law in the future. And I think, quite frankly, the effort to deflect and distract voters who support Trump from this issue is something that the conservative media is certainly helping the Trump administration with quite a bit.
We just have a little bit of time left, but I do want to ask you one final question. There is some speculation that Papadopoulos, who has pled guilty to lying to investigators in the Russian probe, might have been wearing a wire and recording some conversations that he may have had over the summer through the early fall. Have you heard anything about this? Is there any evidence to suggest that this, in fact, has been a strategy employed by the Mueller team?
Well, that is certainly what we have heard. Like, it seems like prosecutors wanted to get as much information as possible with him directly from individuals he was in conversation with. But that has yet to be, confirmed. I mean, several legal experts and, like, former U.S. government attorneys said that was likely. But I'm sure if that was actually the case, that'll be clear in the oncoming months, if not weeks, considering that this investigation is nowhere near over.
Indeed, it is not. Neither is our coverage of it. Eugene Scott from The Washington Post, we really appreciate your time. Thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You take care.
Eugene Scott reports on politics and identity for the Washington Post politics blog called The Fix. We'll have more of the Midday News Wrap coming up after a break. We're going to turn our attention to international news, particularly Africa, with Amira Woods. She's a scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.